Welcome to Artificially Intelligent Marketing, a weekly podcast where we stay on top of the latest trends, tips, and tools in the world of marketing AI, helping you get the best results from your marketing efforts. Now let's join our hosts, Paul Avery and Martin Broadhurst.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Artificially Intelligent Marketing, episode 44. And you're all thinking, where have the guys gone? I haven't heard from them for ages. And we are sorry, but we are here today because it's been a fairly big week in the world of AI. And so we thought, what better time to bring our podcast back alive than this week? So it's me, Paul Avery here, co-host as usual with my fantastic partner in crime, Martin B. How are you, Martin?
I'm glad to be back.
It's just nice to be back, isn't it?
Yeah, everyone thought we'd forgot, but we hadn't. We're still here.
Right. We are very sorry because we've been off air for probably as many as 8 weeks now and a lot of cool stuff happened. And so make sure you sat down, get a coffee. We are going to go super speedy through a lot of different things that happened. We're not going to go through them in too much detail. They're probably old news now, such as the speed of things in AI, but some of the things are cool. What did we miss? Well, we missed Figure One, the robotic company who partnered with OpenAI on a very interesting demo where they basically gave the Figure robot OpenAI GPT-4's vision capabilities and text capabilities and speech capabilities. So basically, the Figure robot could see what was going on around it, interact with a human, and basically respond to queries. It was kind of cool. That was pretty awesome. What else happened, Martin?
Well, we had Devin, which was a AI-powered software engineer, was previewed to much hype. It was able to autonomously plan and then execute a bunch of tasks, completing 14% of actions unassisted compared to about 1 or 2% of actions. However, when you scratch the surface slightly, a few people are somewhat skeptical with the performance, and I don't think this is something that's going to be production ready in a hurry. But it was, for a brief moment at least, an exciting look into the future of agentic AI.
Agentic. Martin got the word agentic straight in. He was just straight back in the mix and he's getting the favorite word out. I love it. I love it. This is how we need to roll. Other things that happened is Claude 3, right? Claude released a new model. They have a bunch of flavors, Haiku, Sonnet, and Opus. Opus being the biggest model, super powerful. And for a short while, at least, took top model spot off of GPT-4 for many use cases. We played with it lots, Martin and I. We found it better at writing in terms of its stylistic capabilities and just to write more naturally like a human. It also was awesome at things like needle in a haystack test. So it was really, really good at summarizing things like call transcripts. Didn't really miss too many important details and was pretty awesome. But of course, there was some news this week, both from Google and from OpenAI, that might surpass some of that. But we had Claude 3. What else did we have, Martin?
HeyGen, the AI avatar company, they're specializing in lots of video production. They created a user-generated content tool, meaning marketers can use HeyGen avatars to create what looks to be user-generated content. Now, there is obviously a question around, should you be using fake user-generated content? There's an ethical question there. But I think if you want to overlay some customer reviews that are genuine and push them into video content that looks like real users working at home or in the office or on the move, speaking directly to camera, then HeyGen with the UCG update can enable you to do that.
That was actually really weird and cool because we've obviously shared quite a few HeyGen things on, you know, when we're out on the speaking circuit or speaking at conferences, and the videos are getting so much better now that even like the little bits that made it kind of were telltale that it was AI generated are starting to disappear, aren't they? It's starting to look much more like truly a human speaking.
Yeah, very much so. Just the lip sync, all of those little elements that would give it away are greatly improved.
Crumbs, crazy. Other stuff, we had Llama 3 from Meta. They released the new version of their model. Interesting thing about this one is Llama 3 also has three flavors, different size of models, in essence, different levels of capability. The smallest model is lightning fast, basically real-time response. The middle model is the one that is the most powerful that they've released so far, and is, at least in some of our tests, almost as good as GPT-4 for certain aspects of things you might be trying to do, for example, summarizing call transcripts. But it's not even the biggest model, which they haven't released yet. So one has to wonder, they're still training it, to be honest. It's one of the reasons we haven't seen it. But when it comes out, I think we can have expectations that it will be a GPT-4 killer, if indeed OpenAI haven't killed their own GPT-4 with their own, you know, the king is dead, long live the king from OpenAI. But that's something we'll talk about in a moment.
Yeah, Llama 3 is a really interesting one. It performs really well at lots of human interaction type tasks of answering questions and producing copy. But in the LLM chatbot arena, where it will often fall down is on things that require, you know, maths capabilities and isn't as good at, say, coding as the other models.
What else do we have, Martin?
We had Amazon Q. So Amazon has released a generative AI-powered assistant that comes in two main versions, Amazon Q Business and Amazon Q Developer. And Amazon Q Business is an AI-powered chatbot that can answer questions, provide summaries, generate content based on data from an entire tech stack for an enterprise system. So taking data from Salesforce, Slack, Microsoft Office 365, things like that. And Amazon Q Developer is something that obviously assists software developers and IT professionals, so it can help with coding, debugging, testing, and has some multi-step reasoning capabilities. Plugs into 40 different enterprise data sources, and it has all of the enterprise-grade security functions that you would expect.
Yes. We also had Microsoft news that Microsoft is developing its own new large model called MAI-1, which is going to be led by Mustafa Suleiman, who was the CEO of Inflection, which created the product Pi that we really liked for a while, until Microsoft basically gutted Pi by bringing all of their staff over to Microsoft and effectively almost purchasing Inflection and the company behind it by buying all of their graphics cards that they got from Nvidia to train models on. That's probably an oversimplified summary, but basically Microsoft went, let's go get some more talent and let's build our own model. And this is very interesting in the context of Microsoft's partnership with OpenAI, at the same time as OpenAI appears to be dancing rather close at the party with Apple, maybe even whispering some sweet nothings into Apple's ear around putting their latest models and their technology into Siri. So there's a bunch of uneasy partnerships forming, and it's interesting to see that Microsoft is now working on its own large model. Watch this space in terms of figuring out how that is going to play out.
As well as that, we had the first commissioned music video produced using OpenAI's Sora. So I actually don't know the name of the band that did this, but it was quite an interesting production process. And if you've been watching, I don't know, Paul, if you've read any reports of people that have been using Sora and trying to use it as a creative tool, it sounds like it's as easy and straightforward to use as using early versions of Midjourney.
Yeah, I think
a nightmare.
Yeah. I think it was an independent artist called Washed Out, and the single was called The Hardest Part. It is interesting. Today I think I sent you an article on the WhatsApps about one of the preliminary testers of OpenAI Sora video model coming clean that their impressive video with balloon head was not quite as AI generated as it appears, because the way that example was positioned, and I think we even talked about this a couple of months ago in our last series of episodes, I think we had an episode on Sora if I remember rightly, but it looked like the whole thing was obviously edited by a human, but been generated by Sora. But actually no, sometimes it generated a floating balloon above a human, and they had to like rotoscope out the human's head, which is not how it was made to appear. So yes, Sora is early Midjourney. It does cool stuff. It's almost sounds extremely difficult to control and get what you want out of it. Obviously most of us don't even have the chance to play with it yet, So I think you're right. I think it's video is a really cool area that's improving very quickly, but our ability to actually get interesting stuff that we want out of it is probably a couple of years away, if Midjourney is anything to go by. And then what else do we had? We had AlphaFold 3. So I'm obviously a biology nerd working in life science marketing, and Google DeepMind bringing out their AlphaFold 3 is pretty cool. So AlphaFold 3 is an improvement on AlphaFold 2 because now it can predict the structures of not just proteins, but also DNA, RNA, ligands, and also when they are interacting. So the goal is to move ever closer to being able to simulate biological systems in a computer so that you can predict how different things will interact to help you identify interesting new drug targets, but also more rapidly and easily digitally screen for drug candidates that might interact with those things and get the outcome that you want, whether that's trying to treat Alzheimer's or reduce inflammation or treat cancer. There's a lot of excitement about this, and I'm very excited about it as well. But there is still a need to both validate what the computer thinks through wet lab research and then put those things in clinical trials. So I think if you hear too much hyperbole around how this is going to impact the drug discovery process, it is an awesome tool. I think it will speed up basic research a huge amount, and I think it will also help with huge amounts of the drug discovery process and chop some of the time it takes to find interesting drugs. But there's still some stuff that you have to do in the real world, unfortunately, as it stands. But it's still a big leap forward, and it'll be super cool to see how people play with it. Thank you for letting me nerd out a little bit on that for a while, Martin.
Well, these things are only going to get better from here on in, right? So AlphaFold 2 was, what, last year?
Maybe even older than that, I would say. Maybe 2022?
Was it 22?
Well, yeah, I think so.
Way. It's pretty recent, right? And this is a big step change in a very exciting domain. So fast forward another 2 years, and what's AlphaFold 4 going to give us?
Crumbs. Well, we may even have digital twins. We might be simulating humans at that point. And then, of course, being able to figure out how drugs are going to interact with things when you can simulate maybe a brain or a heart now. Ooh, we're quite into interesting territory in terms of what you might need to do in the real world versus what you can do in the old computer. What else did we see, Martin? One more.
We saw the takedown, it's the only of some well-hyped AI hardware. So the Humane Pin and the Rabbit R1, which were two pieces of AI-powered hardware that had been previewed many months ago. The first editions of them got into the hands of tech reviewers. MKBHD, one of the biggest reviewers of tech on YouTube, does fantastic reviews. He was one of the first to put out some reviews of both of these tools, and yet they didn't land well. They're half-baked. They don't really do anything that you can't do on a smartphone. The user interface for them is just clunky. Everything about them is just hard to use and not at all appealing for anyone. So, yeah, watch this space. I haven't had any interest in buying either of these, but I have pre-ordered the Limitless Pendant, which is a piece of AI hardware, and that should be arriving within a matter of months. So hopefully that is slightly better.
Given the reports that came in about these pieces of tech, I wouldn't like hold your breath, although obviously what you have acquired is cheaper and simpler and much more likely to work, I would think. We haven't had time to talk about the upgrades to Meta's Ray-Ban glasses that have a mic and a camera that are becoming AI enabled, so in essence you can talk to them. And if you think about some of the sort of technological leaps that we've seen this week, that form factor, speaking to your glasses while they can see the world around you, even before we get to technology that can overlay information in your view, which of course is not currently possible in that type of simple glasses form factor, is actually going to be quite interesting. So while some of the early technology hasn't quite panned out, I think we're still just trying to figure out what's the right form factor for different applications. Like you said, are we better off having apps on our phones, apps on our watches, smarter glasses, what I think Rabbit and the Humane Pin have shown is probably those form factors are not that great. Although I think people have had fun playing with the Rabbit. It just couldn't do 90% of the stuff that it was like touted to be able to do. Maybe it will be able to at some point. And they're both really slow at responding, which of course is a very frustrating user experience. But maybe we can use response times, Martin, as a little cheeky segue into one of the bigger weeks that we've had in AI this year, because we're going to spend most of the rest of this episode talking about OpenAI releasing GPT-4o. Yes, these model names are a pain to try and remember and pronounce. Please hire a branding expert at some point, someone. And also Google I.O. conference this week, developer conference, where they also announced a number of significant upgrades to some of the technologies they've released recently, and also gave us a sneak peek of where their technologies, their AI enabled technologies for business and of course marketing, where they expect them to go in the future. To kick things off, Martin, why don't you tell us what OpenAI have been up to this week?
Well, they had a live streamed event from their offices where they announced, as you say, GPT-4o. O stands for Omni. This is their multimodal GPT-4 version. So it's fully multimodal within the same neural network. So what that means is text input, text output, image input, image output, which is really interesting, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, audio input and audio output. So if you've been using the ChatGPT app on mobile, you've probably tried the voice input where you can try speaking to it and it will talk back to you. That was a clever little piece of software engineering by OpenAI, where what they did was they plugged multiple models together. So you had OpenAI Whisper doing the transcription for your voice, and then they had their own text to voice service transcribe OpenAI's GPT-4's responses and speak it back to you. So it was basically cobbling together multiple models to give you the impression of this fully interactive experience. Now, using GPT-4o, all of that is within the one model. So the experience for the user will be much quicker. The model itself, GPT-4, is as good in terms of quality outputs as GPT-4, so they claim, but they're able to offer it at a 50% price reduction, meaning they've made it incredibly efficient, much more compute light, so it doesn't use as much resource per inference. So every time you use it, it just isn't using as much energy and computing power. That's one of the biggest developments, really, is that they've managed to create this model which is so much more efficient. And what that has enabled them to do is release GPT-4o for free to all ChatGPT users. So where free ChatGPT users previously only had access to GPT-3.5, which, as we know, is at this stage not really a great model.
It's pants, mine.
Yes, it's pants. Now, everybody gets this state-of-the-art model for free, and they also get that multimodality experience as well. This isn't actually launched for everybody just yet. This is coming. It's a few weeks away from being fully rolled out and deployed worldwide. But this is what users can expect to see. And you've got to think that this is going to be huge for OpenAI, because there are reports that I've seen that suggest ChatGPT's stickiness isn't very high, that people will sign up, use it once, and then go, oh, yeah, that was kind of interesting, but it was a little bit disappointing. And that's probably because they were using 3.5. But now everybody's going to be able to get this state-of-the-art intelligence for free.
I think this is critical, Martin, because how many people do we speak with who don't have a pro account, who believe that the quality of large language models is what GPT 3.5 can do. They use ChatGPT because it's the one they've heard of. They haven't even thought to go and have a play with Claude because they just haven't heard of it. And are left thinking, oh, AI, why is everybody excited about AI? It sucks, when actually it's GPT 3.5 that sucks. And 4.0 doesn't suck. In fact, it's rather awesome. So I think this will be the opportunity for people. I hope people go back and play again and are like, oh, okay, this is why people were, you know, were impressed. And, you know, there are other models coming soon. We know this is true. But I do think this will be enough to make people go, actually, I can perform some work functions with this. So I think that part in itself is pretty exciting. Before we even get into the expanded capabilities of what multimodal, omnimodal, whatever they're calling it, what it enables.
Yeah, so let's go straight into those, shall we? The first big thing that they really previewed was the voice capabilities. And if you ever used ChatGPT voice mode previously, you'll know that it was a little bit laggy. There was a kind of 3 or 4 second delay between you speaking into the model and then getting a response back. And that's because there were multiple steps in it. As I explained earlier, it was transcribing, it was then sending it off and doing a bunch of other processes with multiple models. Now, because it's all within the same model, it's much, much quicker. So having a conversation in voice mode, which is just like having a conversation on the phone, the model speaks back to you with a typical delay of around 0.2 to 0.3 seconds. So a third of a second delay, quicker than a human. It feels like that. It's so quick. But also, the voice, Paul.
Crumbs, the voice. I mean, Sam Altman and a bunch of other people were just basically tweeting the word her, which for those that have seen the movie, the 2013, I think, movie about AI companions, AI assistants that speak and sound and empathize like humans, but basically live in your ear as an earbud, speaking to you all day, and they can see what you see because of a ironically humane AI-like pin, or perhaps the equivalent, I guess, of putting your phone in your top pocket of your shirt or your jacket. That's kind of been sci-fi pinnacle of, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you had the opportunity to interact with a computer like you're a human? But crumbs, this is pretty close to that. The female voice sounds like it laughs. It kind of almost is borderline flirty, which I think some people have found like a bit creepy. But if you think, like, humans show a lot of dynamism in how they communicate, right? They do laugh, they do tease, they do emote, I guess is the word. And this feels like a massive jump forward to me. Like, I can't believe that more people are not speaking about it, because it's like a human.
Yeah, it's because the model itself has the ability to understand voice, and it isn't using a text to speech to generate the voice. Like you say, it can emote. It can, if you ask it to speak faster, it will speak faster. If you ask it to slow down, it will slow down. If you ask it to whisper, it will whisper. It can do all of that within the voice. And also, in the input of the voice, when you speak to it, it can detect those emotional ranges. So if you are excited, it will detect that you're excited. If you're sad, it will pick up on the fact that you're sad. If you sound somewhat confused or sound a little bit sarcastic, it will pick up on all of these things. It's crazy. And people, I don't think, same as you say there, I think people are sleeping on this slightly, because this capability is, it takes AI to another level.
And we should also say that in a number of the demos, you had the demos during the live event, but there's also a bunch of videos on the OpenAI site, which I recommend everybody interested in this goes and watches. But so we've got humans interacting with ChatGPT, in essence, speaking to it. It speaks back in near real time, so it's like having a conversation with a human. But you can also screen grab images or take pictures on your phone and send those. And effectively live stream video to the app so it can see what you see or what you're doing. And this just opens up a huge amount of use cases. So one of the example videos, somebody gets two phones and they let one version of ChatGPT speak to another version of ChatGPT, and it mimics the customer service conversation about returning an iPhone. And the whole thing happens without any human input right up to the end, when one of the ChatGPTs asks for the person's email address so that they can send over details on how to do the return shipping. And the other ChatGPT says, please hold, and then goes, Bob, check your email. Did you get an email from the service provider or something similar to that? And it was like, wow, this is not far away. So customer service on the phone is very, very close to getting the level of disruption that we all predicted was going to come. In another example, we had the team from the Khan Academy showing a demonstration of how the tool could be used as a personal coach and tutor. And in this example, using the new desktop app, which has also been released, and it looks like it will be on iPad and Apple devices to begin with, not Windows. Maybe looking back at some of the friction and tension that we talked about at the beginning. But in this particular example, a teenager is being taken through a fairly complex math problem, you know, teenage 14-year-old mathematics problem around right-angled triangles and what have you. And because ChatGPT can both have a conversation with the person but also see what's on their screen, it can ask questions and provide feedback to the person about what they're trying to do. And this is fundamentally mind-blowing, because Martin and I were talking off air, this fundamentally changes how these tools can interact with us. If ChatGPT can see your desktop while you're working, you can ask it questions when you get stuck, and it can be constantly watching what you do. Obviously, privacy and a number of data issues around how we feel about that, but basically coaching you on how to do things well. Like, I've written an email, I'm about to send it. Before I do, ChatGPT just says, Paul, just so you know, that last statement's a bit confusing. You might want to consider rewording it because other people might not be able to understand it. Do you want me to have a go at rewording it for you? Yes, please, ChatGPT. Or maybe, I don't know if you realize, Paul, but that last statement could be seen as a bit inflammatory. Do you want to soften it down for this email? Yes, ChatGPT, I think that would be a good idea. Not least, part of the announcement that seems to have gone live today is the ability of ChatGPT to natively integrate with Google Drive and Microsoft OneDrive files. So we can actually pull information from your existing system. We're probably not that far away from it doing that dynamically at the moment. You have to tell it what file you want to work with. So it can say things like, Paul, do you think it would be useful to attach this thing to this email, given that it's about this topic? Like, this is how the world is going to be very soon, I think, Martin. And it's, I think we've got the potential for all of us to have at work an AI coach helping us get better and better at what we do with personalized coaching, which I think would be amazing. But the downside of that is, once it gets good enough to coach us on a lot of these activities, all it needs is the power to be able to move your mouse and click for you. And then it's, do you need the human to be doing the things at all? And I guess that's where it gets a bit draconian. And we were talking offline, this is kind of weird. Like, where's this going to head up? I don't know what you think about some of this stuff, Mike. It's pretty mind-blowing.
I mean, it still makes mistakes. Right. So I think that's going to work in the human's favor for a while, until it is reliable to such a degree that, you know, you can just chuck it a task and know it's going to get done. At the moment, it does still make mistakes. I've tried it with some coding tasks, and, I mean, before this call, I was saying it's amazing. You can give it a solid brief and it will perform full one-shot coding outputs, complete and whole, that work brilliantly, better than GPT-4. So it's definitely, I feel it's a step on from that, and I've seen other people in the community that are pushing these models saying the same thing as well. But then it still does make some mistakes, and I've had it spit out a few errors in various instances. So I think we're safe from that for a while yet. It's funny you mentioned about just having it as an assistant. Sam Altman did an interview on, I can't remember which podcast it was now, but straight after the announcement, this podcast was published on this fella's feed. And Sam Altman was asked how he's been using this new model, and he said he's only had access to it for a week. Now, whether that's true or not, we'll put it. He described his interactions with it, and he said what he does is he has it, the conversation, he just has the chat mode open on his desk while he's doing some work, and it's just there, sitting there, always listening. And rather than flicking between tabs to find out information or to go and do things that he would normally kind of second screen, what he's doing is he's just asking this. He's just speaking to it as he's going, and he's finding information as he goes, and it's pulling back responses to him, and it's helping him not have to second screen. It's just like a helpful assistant, right? That's what it's
right.
That's how it's been positioned.
Yeah, and I think there was another podcast, and I'm going to paraphrase his. Hopefully I don't drift too far away from what he originally said, but he was being asked, like, what does he think these systems, like, what does he want these systems to be able to do? It was on the All In podcast, actually, on Saturday, or Friday it's released. And in essence, what he wants is, in a business context, is a highly capable executive assistant that can do things on his behalf, but that can really act independently because it has an ability to understand the context of the problems that he's dealing with and the tasks he's trying to execute, and can support them thoughtfully and, wherever possible, autonomously. So it's clear that that's the vision of where they're trying to head. They keep telling us that there's been a couple of podcasts recently that GPT-4 kind of sucks. And yeah, GPT-4.0 is an improvement and it has some really cool stuff, but it suggests that some of the other things they're working on might imply that even some of the aspects of these models kind of suck as well. So I think you're right. I do think the capacity for mistakes is still fairly large, and a human in the loop is absolutely critical. I would love to see us discussing GPT-5, which is rumoured before the end of the summer, but we shall see how much of an improvement it brings, how much improvement it brings in terms of its agenticity. Another little riff on your agentic there, mate. Because, of course, if it can reliably perform multi-step tasks, reason within those tasks, and now we have this ability to show it what we're doing, speak to it in real time, that's going to be really, really interesting. And to finish the thought on the coaches versus the AI does it for us, it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out, because one of the things you and I have discussed is, will there be policies that are put in place that says AI can be a coach for certain roles and it can coach a human to do them, but it can't do the work itself, right? To maintain, A, because that might be safer in a lot of roles where we just can't afford for the AI to make a mistake, but also to ensure that some level of, you know, human first AI is maintained, because that might be needed as it gets better and better and better. So it's super fascinating, quite impressive, and I'm personally looking forward to it being released, because if you go into ChatGPT now and you've got a paid account, you'll see you can access 4.0 already, so you can take advantage of a number of the multimodal things that Martin described. But what you won't be able to do yet is speak with it, because that hasn't been released yet. You've just got the demo videos for now.
And there is some capabilities that they didn't feature in the live stream when they announced it, but when you go into the article where they talk about the capabilities of this model, they shared some of the image output. So at the moment, if you ask for an image in ChatGPT, it uses the DALL-E 3 model. But this model has baked into it image capabilities that it can output. And there's some really cool examples. There's an example where there's a coaster, and it's a coaster with like a marble top half and a wooden bottom half. And then they upload a photo of this coaster, and they upload a separate photo of the OpenAI logo. And they say, we want to mock up what the OpenAI logo would look like if we got it manufactured and printed or kind of engraved into the coaster. And the model does it. But it creates this image using, well, it kind of merges them both together. And it looks legit. It doesn't look like a diffusion model where you get something like if you've done with DALL-E, you might describe that scene to it, and then it gives you an output where it's like, oh yeah, that's kind of what I was after. But if you asked it to do it again, it'd be a slightly different version. It would be slightly tweaked. No, this does look like the original image with the logo attached to it. Writing on images, so text on images, wildly improved. There was an image shared by Greg Brockman on Twitter or on X, where it showed an image that it had created where it was a photo of somebody writing on a blackboard, and it was a full passage of text, and it was the full text, legible, not with that weird, almost hieroglyphics kind of text that you often get with the diffusion models. And all of that's because it's a full multimodal text, image, everything's in the same neural network, and it can do all of these things just better.
I need to get in and play with some of those image capabilities, because I haven't had much of a go yet with that part of it, if I'm completely honest.
It's not launched.
Oh, we can't access it yet.
No, much like the voice. Not there yet. This is all just in the articles and on the previews.
There's been some complaints as well that people who've got GPTs set up, their GPTs can only run off of GPT-4, not 4.0 as it stands, even though, you know, there's a lot of excitement, obviously, about using 4.0 for this. So, yeah, I mean, there's one more thing we'll talk about when it comes to ChatGPT improvements in a minute, but it's part of this. There's such a desperation, I think, with these tech companies now to be seen to be ahead, that they'll talk to you about cool stuff that they can do, and then you might get it in 2 or 4 or 8 or 12 weeks or maybe never. And that is a little bit frustrating for the user. Now, to give OpenAI their due, there's a bunch of stuff 4.0 related that was available. Basically, I had 4.0 on my phone about an hour after the live stream ended. So, you know, props to them for that. But of course, there's some cool stuff that we can't access. And that's kind of frustrating because we want to play with it. And of course, OpenAI organized their event for the Monday before Google I.O. on the Tuesday. And as we'll talk about, live streaming video and real-time responsive voice assistance was kind of part of what Google presented as well. So there's definitely an arms race here, and OpenAI doing their classic trolling of having an event just before Google have an event to try and usurp them in that by doing that. But
did you see the tweet from Sam Altman about Google?
Go on, tell the listeners.
That's right. He said, I try not to think about competitors too much, but I cannot stop thinking about the aesthetic difference between OpenAI and Google. And he's got two photos from their live streams, their respective live streams. And it's the kind of mid-century quiet little OpenAI office stream on one, and the big, bold, brash, somewhat trippy Google live stream stage setup. And the comparisons between them. But the thing that I thought interesting in that was he's directly said, I try not to think about competitors too much. And he's putting them side by side as competition now, which I don't know that I've seen him do before.
There's been some twitchiness on Twitter/X, actually. There was someone who used to be at OpenAI that's now at Google who shared a video of showcasing similar abilities, like pre-Google I.O., to be honest, as OpenAI had just launched, like an hour after the stream, as like an attempt to sort of say, hey, we've got something similar tomorrow, so don't think you're too cool. And of course, all these things are getting retweeted and there's loads of comments. So it is really interesting to see how we've had social media for a long time. And I don't know if this is just because it's something I'm super interested in. The brand awareness and PR work that the likes of Sam Altman are doing, primarily using cryptic tweets as the main mechanism for driving ridiculous amounts of discussion on Twitter, on Reddit, as the main mechanism of disseminating information, building hype. Like, it's proper, you know, super modern PR 101 in terms of they, to a certain extent, they don't even really issue traditional press releases. They write blog posts, they write a tweet about it, and then all the media picks it up off a blog post. from a sort of marketing and comms standpoint, it's really quite interesting to watch. And we had Sam Altman alluding to a bunch of different stuff, was super cryptic in the run-up to the event. So, yeah, I guess that's interesting. But in the interest of time, there's one more thing from OpenAI this week in that they've just improved their data analysis tool. So one of the key questions here is, if I can have GPT-4o for free, why should I still pay for Plus and Teams and Enterprise and all this stuff? And to a certain extent, that's still to be answered. But one of the power features of current paid parts of ChatGPT is its data analysis tool, which is really, really cool. And I think it's today they have improved the tool. So now you can upload files directly from Google Drive and Microsoft OneDrive, which we talked about earlier. You can interact with tables and charts in this new expandable view, and you can customize and download charts for use in your presentations and documents. There are also sort of improvements in its ability to understand data sets and perform analysis tasks. And that this is going to be available for people who are basically paid users. So it's very new news. We haven't had a chance to too much to play with it. I think it's been getting incrementally better over time, and they haven't been talking about it, to be honest, because some of the analyses that I tried to run 6 months ago with GPT-4 have got better with things like the release of GPT-4 Turbo, where they haven't really talked about it. So I'm quite interested to get in and play with this, because I do find it's quite useful for guiding me through analysis of data, suggesting analyses I might do, and helping me understand some of the patterns in data a bit easier, which is kind of interesting. I don't know what you think about this, mine.
I tried 4.0 to do some data analysis this week. I actually just got a dummy data set just to see what it would look like, and it was like four different CSVs related to airline loyalty programs. It's a publicly available data set, and I just chucked it in and said, analyze this, visualize it, and do a statistical analysis. And it did a huge amount of output in a single shot. It does multiple steps of the analysis. It starts off telling you what data there is, just literally, okay, these are the files you've got, this is the kind of data I think we can get. And it's a really, really long, comprehensive analysis, which is, there's one, two, three, four. There's multiple charts provided in this analysis. In fact, I've just counted them up. There's five charts that it provides in this single analysis. It gives you insight into what they mean. So it gives you like seasonal trends, customer loyalty, high value segments, and retention strategies to deploy. Or from just a single prompt. Like, this is not a really detailed, highly configured prompt engineering piece. This is just like, hey, here's some data, analyze it and visualize it for me. Tell me what it means.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to go in and play with it next week. It's also, I don't think we've mentioned this yet, but it's also markedly faster. Like, one of the things about GPT-4 is I could read its outputs faster than it could produce them. But now it just spills down the page much faster than I can read, and I have to, you know, catch it up, which I kind of like, because it means I can skim read a bit more. But it's also a slightly different experience, if I'm honest, because it's like, oh, like if it's verbose, then you're like, oh, crumbs, man, I don't know if I could be bothered to read all of this. But when you're like word by word, then you would. So I don't know if my sort of ability to pay attention to it's going to change somewhat. So loads of great stuff going on over at OpenAI. And I think if you've only been using their free tool so far and you weren't very impressed with GPT 3.5, it's worth logging into your free account one more time and giving GPT-4o a try, because I think you'll find it's quite a bit better than you remember. The other thing we recommend is go and read the launch blog post about this new model, because there's lots of different nuances to sort of how it works and that we haven't had a chance to cover today, such as it can apparently detect emotion in your voice, the tool can sing if you ask it to, and there's a bunch of interesting videos where it's messing stuff up, which just goes to show it's still prone to errors and hallucinations and all the good stuff that we've had to come to expect with models. But yes, well done OpenAI for an interesting release. And now, hot on the heels of that, we've got Google I.O. Mine, what happened over at Google I.O.?
What didn't happen? And I think we might need another hour-long episode just to get through it all. In fact, if you really want to get through everything, they have put together a blog with the 100 things announced at Google I.O., and I'm sure there was probably more than 100, but they rounded it down just to get it in. It really is a massive list, and we could go down the rabbit hole of Android updates and developer updates, but I think what we'll try and do, you know, keep it business and marketing focused. Otherwise, well, we're not getting out of here before Monday at this rate.
Yeah, I agree.
So the main things, we'll start with the model updates. There were some updates to Gemini 1.5 Pro that we have seen. This is now available to everybody and had been made available through Vertex and AI Studio a few weeks ago. But the main difference on 1.5 Pro is that it has now got another increase in its context window. It was already 1 million tokens in the context window, and they've just doubled that. So it's now a 2 million context window large language model, which is immediately just kind of mind-blowing.
It's getting very Dr. Evil now, Martin. I think it's like 1 million tokens. How can you even get enough information to ram into that? I don't know, but I'm sure we'll find use cases.
No, and every inference that you run, I think at 1 million tokens, it comes out at around $7 per input.
Wow.
So every time you input, $7 gone. Well, there or thereabouts. So, yeah, that's pretty impressive. Now, we haven't compared 1.5 Pro with Advanced 1.0. But that massive context window does give amazing capabilities in terms of recall and just, you know, enhancing its overall knowledge. They also announced a new Gemini 1.5 model, which is 1.5 Flash, which is a faster, efficient model designed for large scale applications where you don't need that, where you don't need that additional capability and speed of inference is more important. That's also 2 million token context window.
I've been playing with that one, actually, Martin. I've been very lucky. Both OpenAI's new 4.0 model and Gemini 1.5 Pro 2 million context and Flash were available in my favorite tool, Magi, as you know. So I've got in and played with that. And one of the cool things about Flash is it's cheaper, but it's still pretty good at picking out information from large bits of context, like a call transcript. So giving the same sort of power, but with lower cost. I'm a bit reticent to like push Magi too hard, like you said, because it costs a bajillion dollars to run and too many large prompts through it. And the way the Magi structured is after a certain amount of context, you start to pay for that. But early testing is, I definitely think it's got some interesting use cases as a faster, cheaper model. I think it's also interesting that it's just so hard to keep up with all these model names and what they do, right? It's like, this is not like product development. It's like GitHub forking, because they're kind of sort of pushed advanced into the background a bit now. And I think if you are a paid workspace user, a Google workspace user, my impression, I'd have to validate this, but my impression is we're on advanced now, but the 1.5 Pro's large context window and some of the interesting things it can do is going to be the model of that gets baked into workplace instead of Gemini Advanced. Super confusing. So who knows what model we've got?
Well, Gemini Advanced now has a 1 million token context window.
Oh, okay. So they are trying to, they're running them concordantly. Like, what's the, I don't know.
And if 1 million isn't enough for you, Paul.
Crikey. Dude, I want to feed it every film I've ever seen that I love and tell it to create a new movie for me on the fly. We're not there yet. We're not there yet, people, but we could be soon.
The Gemini Advanced updates were quite interesting. So they've expanded the context window. So that means you can analyze 1,500 pages of PDF document. You can upload directly from Google Drive. They also have included data analysis and chart building for updated data files. And they've added this. This is more of a consumer facing functionality, but they've added custom itinerary creation for travel planning, and it looks at the keywords are used in a different way and is able to build an itinerary for your trip. Now, I've already tried this out with things like ChatGPT for my own little travels, and I'd always found it to be pretty good at finding some places that I might not have thought about before. But yeah, this has got this as well now. They've got Gemini Live, which they've announced, which is a natural intuitive spoken conversation, which apparently can be used for customer service and support, similar to 4.0.
I think this will be important. I think this would be important, Martin, because they're calling it like Project Astra. And you can basically show it a real-time feed of what's going on around you and have a conversation with it, very much like the sort of omni-channel GPT 4.0. So the cynic in me is that OpenAI found out what Google were going to launch on the Tuesday, and they had something similar, and they thought, well, we better get that out on the Monday then, hadn't we? Because they seem pretty comparable to me. There's a slightly longer delay on Gemini's response time in terms of having a natural conversation, but you can do the same things you can with GPT-4.0. You can interrupt it mid-flow. It's got much more emotive capability in its voice. How well it understands human emotions and tonality is not clear at the moment, but yeah, it feels a bit much for muchness, which just goes to show, within like a few days, we're already like, oh, okay, that's the state of AI now, like, show me the next thing.
Absolutely, it becomes table stakes, doesn't it? Everybody's now looking at Anthropic going, come on, where's your voice assistant?
Right, it's mad. Like, the human's ability to, like, not be impressed by this stuff anymore is kind of astounding. And it fits very much with what, you know, OpenAI's goal was, as you said at the beginning of the podcast, to release things incrementally so that we didn't have a big shock. And I think one of the byproducts of that is we actually adapt quite quickly, and we're already saying what's next, rather than being like, oh my gosh, the world is being completely turned upside down, which, you know, if you'd been living in a bunker for 18 months is exactly how you'd feel. You'd come out and you'd go, sorry, when did Star Trek get here? Like, how have we gone from one paragraph out from GPT-3 to Sora video generation and basically a computer I can speak to that laughs and jokes back with me? Like, it's mind-blowing, really. But
yeah,
you know,
that's happened. If you think about, you know, ChatGPT was November 2022. I think people, that was no time ago at all. Before that, most people, and even today, most people haven't really dug into large language models. But before then, it was a tiny proportion of people that had ever used large language models. Yeah, it's amazing. So what else have we got coming out of the I/O event? Image generation. They have updated their image generation diffusion model, Imagine, which is now Imagine 3, which is available to trusted testers on the Google platform. And that's in Image Effects, and it's coming to the Vertex AI platform later in the summer. They also announced Veo, which is a kind of Sora competitor. So generating 1080p resolution videos in various styles, suitable for marketing videos, stock video creation, content creation, and that kind of thing. Did you get a look at any of the clips of Veo?
Yeah, so I've been looking at what the Twitter spheres had to say about the image generation and the video generation for those that have been able to play with it, and also those that have just watched the demo. And it would appear that the image generation is much better, probably DALL-E 3 level, but not Midjourney level. So it's probably Midjourney that's still just edging ahead in terms of the most powerful image generator. The video examples I've seen are impressive. They're certainly better than what we used to have coming out of Runway, but they're not as good as Sora at first viewing, I would suggest. So, but I think what it tells you is the magic that created Sora was not unique, because this is pretty close, even if it's maybe slightly behind.
Yeah, the ones I've seen look great. Again, with all of these tools, though, it's about getting into the hands of real users, isn't it? Because as we discussed with Balloon Head, it's okay showing the final output that's been edited and manipulated, but until you get it in the hands of users and people start prompting it and going, God, this is nearly impossible unless I use 1,000 prompts to get the video I want, we won't actually know how good these tools are. Now, I just want to focus on one area for the digital marketing listeners in our audience, and that is search, because there have been some massive announcements on the search front. Anyone that's been paying attention to the search generative experience, SGE, will know that Google has been testing for some time inserting AI-generated responses at the top of search results, bumping down all of the organic search content. And this is now being rolled out in what Google is calling Google AI Previews. And this will be rolled out in America first and then across the wider world soon after. And it's fair to say, people that pay a lot of attention to this online and in the Twitter sphere are not impressed. This is pulling out some very strange results. There are examples where people are saying, look, this is virtually just pure plagiarism. And there is a general consensus amongst SEO professionals that, hey, look, we are heading towards Google zero-click environment, where Google passes through very, very little organic traffic to informational searches.
Yeah, this is, we've talked about this on the podcast multiple times. I think even when I think about my own behavior, thanks to you, I probably turn to Perplexity as often as I do turn to Google, if not more often. Perplexity is great. It gives you a load of sources. It tells you where it got its insights. I don't click through to visit them. In fact, if I want more clarification, I ask a follow-up question of Perplexity. I don't go clicking through and reading stuff, if I'm completely honest. The only time I'll ever click through is if my spidey sense is like, no, I don't think that's right. And I'm basically validating hallucinations when I'm clicking through. So I think there's a user behavior change coming here that's also in tandem with technology changes. And as you say, as a content publisher, not just, you know, traditional publishers, but basically companies leveraging content marketing to drive traffic through SEO and sell products and services, to what extent is that going to work well in X time frame? And I think one of the hard things with this is to predict exactly how SEO shifts and that time frame, right? Because it could take 12 months for SGE to just get really good and be rolled out widely, and then the amount of clicks that people are clicking through to informational content just drops off a cliff. Or the whole shift in behavior could be 5 years. You know, if we're speaking with computers, certainly maybe, you know, ChatGPT or Gemini will pull up a source while we're having a conversation with it and say, hey, look, this is the article where I got some of these insights from. But if I'm not even looking at my screen because I'm just getting the information from a direct conversation, this is going to cause fundamental shifts in terms of how people go to market, especially if they rely a lot on SEO. And we've talked a lot about how more than ever brand becomes extremely important, especially if we've already got an established brand, because I think establishing a new brand through content marketing is going to get harder and harder. And leveraging the expertise of your, if you're in a B2B environment, leveraging the expertise of your SMEs whose knowledge maybe doesn't exist on the web and therefore cannot be surfaced by an AI tool, and therefore your voice is still a trusted voice because you can share things that AI can't. So it's going to be really interesting to see this play out, isn't it, Martin?
It is. It's real chicken and egg in terms of how, maybe that's not the right phrase, chicken and egg, but it's a conundrum for publishers to think about how they want to treat the AIs. Like, the AIs need the latest information. So if you're a publisher, you've got the researchers, you've got the expertise, the authority, all of the stuff that Google says you currently need, the EAT framework, you know, experience, expertise, authority, trustworthiness. You've got all of that within your industry and you can be writing about it. And it's the same with the press, right? If you're the Washington Post or Financial Times, you've got journalists that are subject matter experts that go out and gather the information. And the AI then needs to trawl that information. Otherwise, it won't know it. Now, if Google is always serving, if people's behavior changes that they just expect the AI to provide the answer, you as a publisher need to determine whether you want to feed that in. Now, Google has made it available to, or have made the functionality available to basically de-index from search. So you can say, index me for search, but don't index me for the AI search specifically. So remove me from your previews tool. And we've seen a similar thing with OpenAI. They've made the same thing available as well. But then your potentially your business is not getting mentioned in all of these things where people are going to increasingly be turning to for their answers. So what do publishers do? Do you have to strike a deal with these companies like OpenAI has done recently, signing lots of deals with the likes of Reddit, and large publishing companies are signing deals so that OpenAI can use their data? Is that how they start revenue generating? What about if you're a small B2B? If you're a manufacturer who's done really well by positioning yourself as an expert in the field, but all of a sudden your blogs are being scraped by the AI, and the AI is just going, yes, this is the answer about that really niche, special thing that normally we'd have sent a load of traffic to your website for, but now we're just giving them the summary straight away on the search page. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, and I think the publishers are probably doing the right thing. And I think, honestly, we'll win if we have good licensing deals between the publishers and the AI models, because we need high quality journalism for a number of different reasons. And as you said, if the information's not there for AIs to scrape, then the AIs won't know the things that we need them to know. I think the challenge when you're a small or a mid-sized B2B, or even a massive B2B company, to be honest, is your business model is not the information you produce. This has been like content marketing has basically been an element of, we give some of our expertise away as a freemium type model in the hope that you'll come buy some products and services from us because you'll trust us and think we're awesome. And does the commercial imperative hold up if you're producing content that's consumed by AIs that drives the advice and information they give, but without citing you as a source? And ultimately, I think the answer to that probably is no. So either B2B has to move away from that type of model, or OpenAI, Google find ways to, either through paid means or organic means, better cite the sources that they're using. And I can see that paid means is the most likely. One of the key questions, for large language models is, and for OpenAI and Google, if Google disrupts its ad revenue, its pay-per-click Google ad revenue through this model, that's where it gets most of its cash. So it's not going to let that happen. So at some point, we have to expect to see some sort of advertising elements baked into this. The other thing is, are consumers going to consistently spend $20, $30, $40, $50 a month on a ChatGPT, or is it going to be mostly used by businesses? And this is, again, a question we don't know. If people are not willing to pay a monthly subscription for it, it will need to be an advertising-driven model, which again will completely influence the answers that are given, how you trust them, how companies' products and services are weaved into those. So I still think there's a bunch of unanswered questions here. But, what advice would you give to a B2B company, Martin, that maybe produces lots of written content relying on search? What advice would we give them at this point in time, given potential avenues that this could go down?
New formats, new channels, video, audio, podcasts. I would make sure that you are turning that content into different channels. They still have legs, they still have reach, and it can all be turned into written content. And you can actually use the AI to your advantage by taking a transcript from a podcast and turning it into a series of blogs. But yeah, I would be looking at that, social and influencer type content, even in B2B, works very well. It might not be that you're going to be out there making loads of TikToks. It might be, but find your channel and stick to producing content regularly for that channel in multimodal. Don't think that blogs are going to be here forever. They might supplement, but yeah, I would be looking to diversify the range of media formats that you produce for.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I also think it's almost old school now, but a lot of the original content marketing business models were about generating subscribers. And I think subscribers becomes critical, right? Because you can no longer rely potentially on search for your content to be found. You need to become a trusted voice. That's always been true. That's always underpinned a lot of content marketing. But you need people to subscribe to your YouTube channel, to your podcast, to your newsletter, so that you have a means of getting in front of them consistently and being the trusted voice that they listen to. So I think you combine all of those things together
and you can ride out the diminishing search traffic. But I think if you're relying on keyword optimizing blog posts as your only strategy, I think that probably doesn't end well over the next 2 to 3 years. And, you know, best time to plant a tree is 10 years ago. Second best time to plant a tree is today. So this is, if you're not thinking about this, I think today is the time to start thinking about that. And of course, you can always contact us because we think about this a lot and we may be able to help you. There were some other things that I really thought were interesting at the event, Martin, and it's kind of, I'm surprised it's flown a little bit under the radar, but they reference something called AI Teammate that they've been playing with internally, and they kind of inferred that this is what we can expect to start seeing in 2025. And in essence, it's like a someone in your chat, like where the office is Google, so it was in Google Chat, that is part of the conversation. I think it was called Chip or Clip or something like that, and it was a member of the chat. So you had the project team members there, you had Chip, if indeed that's what it was even called, conversing back and forth, and the human would say, where are we on project X and what are the bottlenecks that's holding us back? And then the AI teammate would go check all the chat messages, all the relevant emails, all the relevant documents saved on the Google Drive system, and then come back with an update on where the project's at and what the bottlenecks are and what decisions still need to be made and by who. And then multiple people start having this conversation where the AI teammate is very much part of that conversation. And it was just a really interesting demonstration of this agent type approach, but in an extremely accessible business context, right? Like just someone in your chat that could well be a human, really. And that's kind of how the interface worked. I thought it was interesting. Did you see this, Martin? What did you think?
Yeah, so it was the teammate Chip. And you have to basically tag it into information so you can copy it into email threads. And as long as it's given access to these files, if you're sharing files in the project or, like I say, copying it into email chains, it will have access to that information. So you do have to think of it as this extra teammate, and then it will respond in the chat. I think the example that they gave with the image was on the video was Project Sapphire, and somebody puts in the chat, are we on track for the launch? And then Chip jumps in and says, there are conflicting decisions on the target audience for launch. And then it's got references to documents where it talks about this conflict. It says, getting aligned on this is important for our marketing timelines. Here are the latest timeline for Project Sapphire. And then it lays out development timeline, design and prototyping, testing and marketing. And it's all there right in the Google chat interface, which, yeah, I think that's super cool. And I think we can expect to see this kind of thing rolled out in the future with Teams, and keep an eye on this because the Microsoft Developer Conference is coming up next week, and Slack AI announced a new AI assistant. And if you're a Slack user, you might want to check the terms and conditions on that, because all of your data is going into the training for that model. That's a conversation for another day. But yes, I think we can expect that these places where we're all working, chatting and collaborating are going to have these new AI assistants where we can tag them into email threads, into documents. We'll be able to probably tag them on Word docs and into Excel sheets, and they'll just be part of the collaborative experience.
Yeah, do you know, it's fascinating. We've talked before on the podcast about how we're on exponential curves in different areas, and different technologies and different past discoveries, if you like, have enabled where we are today in strange ways, right? We've talked about how the advent of the internet, and to a certain extent, even publishing and content marketing itself, have been critical for creating the volume of content needed to train these models, right? Without the internet, you don't get this. And without a bunch of content on pretty much every topic you can think of, these AI models have very limited knowledge. But when I reflect upon this type of tool, it at the moment somewhat relies on everything being digital, right? By definition, it can only update you on your query if there is an email or a document somewhere that has that information in. So in-person meetings, that are not recorded or the audio is not captured in some form, it's going to be important information it doesn't have. But of course, post-pandemic, most of us are doing a huge amount of what we do on Teams and other, you know, on Google Meet and other platforms, Zoom, and the use of Slack and Gmail and other tools maybe hasn't increased so much. I mean, I can imagine the use of tools like Slack and messaging probably has, but without the pandemic, I don't think you get this shift in user behavior to everything being online that even gives these tools the ability to, you know, to be a meaningful part of those conversations. And for a lot of businesses that have encouraged fully back to the office working conditions, maybe we're all going to have to wear pendants around our neck, like the one that you've bought, to be able to capture the data to enable our tools to be informed. Because if your chip assistant only has half the information, then to be honest, it becomes fairly useless, because it might just, there might be something really important it doesn't know.
In-person meetings are the key here, aren't they? Because I've started, if I have an in-person meeting with a client, I've gone to their office, I will say, can I record this? I'll stick my phone on the table, and you know, nearly, I've never had anybody say no. And I'll record the session, just capture the audience, capture everything that is said in that room. And then I just upload that to a Google Drive, and I've already got that set up with a Zap on Zapier, which does the transcription, turns in all of the action points, and creates the to-do list. And 9 times out of 10, these are taking place at a client's office. So by the time I drive back to the office, everything's there. Everything's captured and it's shared in a Google Doc, and I've got my follow-up email drafted for me, ready to just tweak and make sure I've got all the details done. But that's going to become more commonplace. And I think things like, you'll probably see specific hardware for it, right? So the intercom or the meeting room technology that exists at the moment with all of the cameras set up and all of that kind of stuff, that's going to have it baked in, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right, because the value of the data to enable these tools will be too important to not do it. It will open up the usual privacy, confidentiality, data security issues that we're used to dealing with, but the productivity gains are likely to drive the behavior changes anyway, I would have thought, but we'll have to see how that plays out. I think that's pretty much it from Google I/O that we would talk about from a business perspective. As Martin said, there are over 100 different announcements, especially like consumer app driven things, like Google Photos is getting a bunch of upgrades and things that you can do with it. So if you are interested in that, we do suggest going and reading the full blog post.
There was one thing that I saw someone post on LinkedIn that I think is valuable for marketers. Chris Penn, who many listeners may know from the digital marketing world, he posted something on LinkedIn observing that Google Chrome in the next update is going to have the smallest Google Gemini model, which is Nano, baked into the browser. So it's going to run locally on device.
Ooh.
In the browser. And he speculated that you will be able to use Nano in any window that has a text drafting element. So whether you're doing an email in Gmail or writing a comment on Facebook, anywhere that you can input text, he estimates that you will likely have access to Nano. And if this is the case, you can expect a significant uplift in the amount of spam comments if you run a Facebook page, a LinkedIn page, or any other community platform for your brand.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because A, it's interesting it runs in browser, right? There's people are sensitive about sending data off to these companies, and if it runs in browser, in theory, your data is more controllable, although I'd put an asterisk and a massive question mark that was like 50 times the font size of the original text, because I'm really not sure that you can truly trust that. But how long before those tools can start taking actions in the browser as well, right? Like Bing to a certain extent already does a little bit of what you just described, in terms of you can select text in like a Google Doc and then Bing open in the sidebar can help you rewrite and things like that, which is interesting. The other thing that we didn't mention was that Gemini has really starting to get much more power in Gmail. And I think the examples from Google I/O were consumer focused, things like summarizing emails around trying to figure out what roofer to hire, I think, for a domestic requirement. But of course, you could see how easily that could be applied to business. So ultimately, there's going to be improvements in the ability of Gmail for you to search for information, for you to summarize information, for you to automatically draft emails and have Gemini basically take action on certain emails for more complex tasks, so that you can do a little bit less of the manual work. So rather than having to read through an email thread or emails from lots of different suppliers, for example, being able to pull that information out automatically. And I think one of the other examples they showed was pulling out like 50 receipts and from emails. And like, it's, for example, if you're a sole practitioner running your own business, and then basically having it pull them out and add all of those receipts to a spreadsheet with a link to the original PDF of the receipt. That was pretty cool. You're nodding, Martin. Did you see that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And that, as somebody who is constantly getting emails saying, have you got this receipt? Have you got that receipt? That absolute game changer for me. I saw that. I thought, I need that in my life immediately.
Right. But it's the gateway, right, to pulling contextually relevant information into a format. And I think there's so many different avenues of where AI will impact on the workplace and how we work. For everything from annoying, time-consuming administrative tasks like this one, through to potentially quite creative brainstorming strategic tasks where the AI is acting as a brainstorm partner and a coach. And it's, I think, I don't see any single one of those being like, yes, that's like 10x the effectiveness of me or my business or whatever. But I think when you start to add them all up, that's where you'll start to see where the big impact is. So there's pros and cons to that. You know, the pro is you can take advantage of the things you need. You don't have to dabble in the things you don't need. The con is, I think maybe some businesses will feel a bit let down when they see that they only get a slight incremental gain here and a nice incremental gain there, right? They'd like to be able to switch AI on and double productivity. But I just don't think it's going to work out like that. I think it's going to be use cases, applications, opportunities and problems, and then applying AI in specific ways across those. And so mid to large companies are probably going to have some sort of chief AI officer or someone who's in charge of understanding what technology is available, what they can do and how to apply them to different use cases and applications in a business to start to realize some of those efficiency and creativity gains, because that's going to probably need to be someone or a team's job in order to deploy across those different functions, but also to, you know, be in charge of the change management, because we're going to have to coach and train and bring humans through on the journey to help them actually adopt the tools. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely agree. And if you think about any piece of software, right? So Microsoft Word has so many functionalities. In fact, actually, PowerPoint is probably a better example, right? Most people can use PowerPoint and throw together a slide deck. But scratch the surface, and lots of people say it's one of the best graphic design tools out there on the market. The functionality that is kind of hidden away and what you can do with it when you scratch the surface is remarkable. And most people use about 10% of it. Microsoft Excel, you're considered to be a kind of intermediate, borderline advanced user if you can use pivot tables and VLOOKUPs, right? These are fairly basic functionalities. But if you're a real power user, there's a huge amount that you can do with it, but most people don't use it. And with AI features and functionalities being rolled out, like the AI extraction of attachments and automatic organization of those for users, unless people know that they're there and how to navigate them, they'll just sit there untapped. Because, as identified with the examples I just gave, most features and functionality does sit there untapped by most ordinary users.
Yeah, I think it's going to be super interesting to see how AI enables that, because you don't know what you don't know, right? So there's probably cool stuff that I could do in Excel to ask interesting questions of data and draw interesting insights. But if I don't know what questions to ask, then I'm not even going to start to think about how I might be able to actually achieve that in terms of analysis. So again, AI as a coach going, you know, Paul, what is it that you're actually looking to find out here? And maybe even having enough context about me, my business, the data I'm looking at to go, do you know what you might find interesting is this? And I'll go, oh, yeah, that does sound interesting. How could we go about analyzing that? And then as we see with the ongoing improvements with the data analysis tool in ChatGPT, the actual ability to write and run Python code to undertake series of analysis steps at this point, let's be honest, to actually dive into that data and, you know, provide those insights, I think that's going to be quite fun. And I think overall, I think, as I said earlier in the podcast, having that AI assistant is going to drag up our skill levels in all the areas where we're a bit weaker and there's lots of stuff that we don't know, because you're just gonna have that AI on your shoulder going, hey, can I help you with this? Have you thought about this? And I think that's going to be quite fun and pretty valuable, as long as we deploy it in a human first way. Because I think until we get into a mechanism where every bit of information is digital, I think there'll be things that humans know about their work and their clients and their colleagues, and that the AIs won't know. And you will need the humans piloting and driving a lot of this. And it's just about augmenting them the best that we can. Well, there you have it, folks. We whistle-stopped through a bunch of stuff that we missed. Sorry for being out and about. We've talked a bit about GPT-4o. We've talked about Google I.O. and loads of cool stuff. We're back in the mix now, so you're going to expect to see us dropping into your favourite podcasting program on a frequent basis, probably every week or two, a little bit like what we used to back in the day. And if you have enjoyed this podcast, please interact with one of our posts on LinkedIn. We'd love to know what you thought of different things in the podcast. You can leave us a review. We'd love that. You can tell your friends, hey, the guys are back, and they are didn't even mention Derby County yet, who got promoted, which we really should
promoted be, you know. Right, next 5 minutes we're in now. What a day, Paul. That was fantastic. Promoted back in the championship where we belong.
See, we only talk about Derby County when they're losing, because that entertains me. But when they're winning and they're doing well, that might entertain you, Ryan. And we can't have that. It's that's outside of time.
Yeah, well, now we have a long rebuilding job ahead of us. But maybe, to pull it back to the world of AI, Derby can tap into the AI tactics tool that was developed by Google DeepMind and launched alongside Liverpool, your team.
That's right, for a better corner taking. But at least we've done the listeners the good grace of putting all of this inane football stuff at the end of the podcast. Okay, right, we will let you go. It's been a super long episode. If you've made it this far, we appreciate you sticking with us, and we look forward to keeping you up to date on all the things you need to know about AI to help you be more effective in your role, run your business better, be a better marketer, etc. in our next episode.
If just one more thing, if there's anything you'd like us to cover in a podcast in the future, email us at hello@artificiallyintelligentmarketing.com.
I think that sounds like a blooming good idea. We'd love to hear from you. Right, we'll sign out there, Martin. Thanks very much for your time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Artificially Intelligent Marketing. To stay on top of the latest trends, tips, and tools in the world of marketing AI, be sure to subscribe. We look forward to seeing you again next week.